Hi everybody, James Chambers here. I am going to talk to you today about building and deploying ASP.NET MVC websites out to Windows Azure. My background is in web development and working in frameworks. I am currently on staff at LogiSense Corp, where we build a product called EngageIP. We help connect systems and different devices as well as users and set up billing and OSS for companies around the globe. Growing company, fun place to work at, and I actively use this stuff on a daily basis. So it's always a treat to be able to share some of what I've learned along the way about the MVC framework and how we can experience a more modern way to deploy things. So we're going to start by looking at what the MVC framework actually is, because it's not just an acronym. There's actually a bunch of stuff loaded up in it. We're going to walk through the steps of creating a new site from scratch. We're going to take a little walk through kind of exposing a little bit more functionality through the entire process. And we're going to add a database to the back end of it. Next, we're going to quickly walk through what it takes to set up and deploy a website out on Windows Azure. And that's one of my favorite parts now where we're at today. So we're going to spend some time on that. And then if we have time, we are going to look at entity framework migrations, which are just a great tool to have in your toolkit. So I guess what we want to do right now is just kind of place where MVC fits in our developer tool chest. And I guess one of the best ways to think about it is that this isn't something that has to replace everything that you've learned and everything that you do on a regular basis. This is just another piece to the puzzle. From this slide here, just kind of looking at the various pieces here, you can see that ASP.NET and ultimately client delivery relies on a number of pieces from top to bottom in the stack. MVC, in particular the MVC Framework 4 and Web API, those fit in a particular place somewhere, what we would say between the client and the actual core of ASP.NET. That said, as it's part of ASP.NET, as it's part of this entire stack, we get to leverage the things that are already mature and already part of ASP.NET that we've been taking advantage of for years. And in fact, with the latest bits in .NET 4, 4.5, and the productivity tools that we've got in Visual Studio 2012, we've just got a lot of really great things that we can now take advantage of as developers. So let's talk about it. MVC is Model View Controller. As far as what happens when we make a request, this is kind of what the steps look like. A request comes in from the browser, hits our controller. Our controller is going to do something. Usually it builds some kind of payload, and that's representative of a model of some kind. The view, again, we think of what goes out to the client as a web page. Of course, we don't build web pages anymore. We use a DSL or a domain-specific language, and we compose an application that actually outputs HTML. And so the view is part of that. One of the language tools that we have there, one of the templating tools that we have, is called Razor, the Razor View Engine, and that is part and parcel with MVC, but you can use it other places in the ASP.NET stack as well as standing alone. So again, this idea of these Lego pieces that fit together to give us something that we can do. So we've got this request coming in, comes into our controller. We either process the message or we use default values to build some kind of payload that we want the user to see. We pass that along to the view if required. And then finally, that view sends the request, the response back to the user. Lather, rinse, repeat. We're just going to keep doing that as long as the user stays on our site, or any time that we want to make any AJAX calls, we're going to be pushing stuff into controllers. The controller's going to be doing things with it, stuffing it back out to the client with some kind of view or at least some kind of data attached to it, some kind of HTTP response. Let's get started. No point wasting any time. I'm going to switch over to Visual Studio. You can follow along if you want, and I encourage you to. This is really as easy as File New Project, and I'm going to show that to you right now. So flipping into you know what? I'm just going to start a new copy of Visual Studio. Here we go. And we will dive into a new project. Right away, we're going to be flipping over to web. We are going to be picking the ASP.NET MVC4 web application. You can see that I'm using the .NET Framework 4.5. I'm going to just leave the application name as is, just because we're going to have a quick view at what this is going to actually entail, what it builds for us. And here's our first glimpse at the MVC4 tooling. What what I'm meaning by this is we actually have a set of templates to choose from that's going to kind of help us kickstart our project. I'm going to go with the baked-in internet application and hit OK. The internet application versus the intranet application gives us form-based authentication using simple membership built on top of the ASP.NET membership stack. That's opposed to using, for example, your Windows credentials to log in with a single sign-in through the browser, for example. So, pops up, we get our home controller. We can, right at this point, we're ready to run the application. So I'm just going to hit F5, compile that guy, and run it. And let's pop up and have a look at what's going on inside the application. Very kind of plain site. It's got some nice roundy features, so I guess that means it's kind of Web 2.0 or something. We've got a login and a register link. These are aspects of membership that are already work and they're pre-configured for us. We also have a couple of links here, so we can go to the About page, just a stock kind of page to send us back to, and a Contact page. These numbers, if you are in Canada, will actually call Jonathan Rosenblatt directly. So you can just call these, dial these up, and you'll get to talk to someone on the Azure team. That's not true. But we can go in and have a look here at what happens when we register on something as well. I just clicked on register. It's going to take a moment for the database to kind of wire itself up and get started. There's a number of conventions that are used, and by default, you don't have to do anything to get an MVC 4 site running with authentication and authorization. Those components just fire up for you. So by clicking on register, what's happening is this, it's checking to see if it's got a connection to the membership database, and the membership database doesn't exist. So it actually goes off and spins one up for me. So I'm going to just go in here and type my name in as James, put in a password. When I can hit register, and now I'm logged in as James. So you can kind of see up in the top corner here, I can go in, and there's even some ability for me to manage my account. There's some other things that we'll talk about with authentication and authorization as well, but you can see here I can change my password if I want to. I can log off. And again, very basic starting point for our application. Now, moving back into Visual Studio, let's have a look at how some of these pieces kind of work. Well, I did see a page. Where does that exist? We've been talking about model, view, controller. How do those things play in our project? If we have a look over at our Solution Explorer, we've got the ability to kind of drill into our controllers. You can see there's a couple of stock ones that are created for us already. We've got the home controller and the account controller. What those do, you can probably guess, but the home controller will accept any of the incoming requests thanks to the routing that happens as part of the MVC framework. And the home controller in this particular instance has the index method, the about method, and the contact. Now, index sounds something that as web developers we're kind of familiar with. This sounds like a default document kind of thing. So that's good. Well, let's have a look at our views here. And you can see that it's returning a view, but it doesn't say which view to return. Again, going back to this configuration, this convention over configuration approach, just by virtue of me having a views directory and in it having a home directory with an index.cshtml, that's enough to wire everything up. I don't need to do much else. So, because of our default routes. So let's have a quick look at this. If I wanted to, I can see here that it's dropping in some this value from viewbag.title, and we've got this viewbag.message. So there's some other interaction layer that's going on. If I jump back over to my home controller, I can see there's a viewbag.message that's being set. So if I want to change this message here, I can do so by saying, welcome to my first MVC site. And next time we run the application, of course, this is going to be what is baked in and parsed out through that Razor view. And when the site loads up, of course, we'll see that welcome message, welcome to my first MVC site. So pretty straightforward. Now, there's a lot to cover here. And as you explore views and the Razor view engine, there's going to be a lot of questions that come up. So make sure you go out and kind of look at some of the sample sites that are out there, look at some of the walkthroughs that you've got the ability to go through. You're going to learn about things like dynamics. The view bag is a dynamic. You're going to learn about things like view models that allow you to represent some data out of your database, but don't force you to use your actual model classes on the view. There's a lot of really good things that you can do to annotate your models and everything. You're going to want to do those in a view model. So a number of things come together in this composition. We've created the site. We've got a home controller. We understand that the home controller has an index method on it. When we say return view from index, we get this razor view back. Everything seems to be coming along, except how does it actually know to return this controller's method called index from the get-go? Well, in app start are a number of classes that you're going to want to become very familiar with. We've got auth config, bundle, filter, route, and web API config. These are default classes with static methods. They're called from global ASAX to wire up your project as it gets started. In this particular case, we're going to look at route config. The only mapped route that we have by default is one that says the default controller is home and the default action to invoke is index. If I change this to contact and press build and run, then what we're going to see when the app launches up is by default requests coming in that do not specify a route that indicates home and index, for example. We're going to see the contact up here. This is the functional equivalent of typing home/contact. You can see it's the exact same page. I can also type in home/index, and that gets routed back through that routing map, or that route that we've mapped. The request goes back to the index method again. So let's have another look at this class in the home controller. Our class is a controller. The methods are actions. And that's our parlance when we're talking about routes inside the MVC framework. So I'm just going to change this guy back to index for the time being. And there's also one more parameter in here. It's called ID. And the URL parameter is optional as specified in our defaults. That means that we're not required to pass it in, but we can in the event that we need to pick up an ID. Again, this is a basic template that you can use. You can define as many routes as you want to, and when you map them, the framework will automatically pick them up and do the best job to match. So instead, if you wanted to, for example, map a controller named product to an action named index, which was your list, but you wanted somebody to be able to type in the browser yourwebsite.com/products, then you could create that route appropriately and have that get routed through to the correct controller and action in your project. So let's do something a little bit more interesting here and have a look at how we can start pushing our own models around through this application. There is also created for us this models directory. Models are basically just classes. I'm going to create a person class in this particular case. And we are going to have a look at what it takes to actually build a website that, not a website, but a controller and some actions that return an actual person. So I'm just going to do a couple of things here. I'm going to do a person ID. We'll come back to that in a second. That one's going to be important. String first name. Get this person some properties so we can help identify them. Last name, and something interesting, int number of pet sheep. There we go. Okay, so the next thing that I want to do is I just want to make the framework aware of this class. So I just quickly build my application, and now this person is kind of more, Visual Studio is aware of the class, and the tooling is aware of the class. Now, in my controllers, I want to add a controller. We're going to call this guy the person controller, and I'm just going to leave it as an empty MVC controller for now. Again, that's another piece of the MVC tooling. When I invoke this dialog for controller, it gives me a number of options that I can use to scaffold out not only a controller, but a set of views. So I've got this person controller in here, and I'm going to create a new person, bring in my models, person. New person, first name James. last name Chambers. Hi, that's me. And we are going to return that person in the view. Now, as a quick kind of demo here, before we kind of get into some of the more meatier work, I'm going to just quickly add a view here, again, more of the tooling that we've got for to support scaffolding inside the MVC framework. And with this, I'm going to actually try and scaffold a view. I'm going to create an index that gives me the details of the person that are being passed to the view. So again, we've got a person class, and we've set some properties on that person. And now we want to show that, we want that in the response to the client, so that the user sees a web page with some details about a person. So the index name pops up automatically. Again, I right-clicked on my index method, my action in the controller. And so the tooling's smart enough to actually pick up that, hey, this guy probably wants a view named index. So I'm going to create a strongly typed view. That is, I want the view to have an awareness of a particular class. And in here, I'm going to just type person, and you can see it's already picked it up for me. Now I'm just going to override the scaffolding template. Scaffolds are a great way to kind of head end a site. They let you quickly build out controllers, pages, these kinds of things, views, with some kind of skeleton kind of representation of what you're trying to do. They don't look the greatest. You're probably not going to go to production with them, but in a lot of cases, they give you a good kickstart, or at least a fairly good stab at CRUD operations on your website. So here I'm going to create a details view, and I'm going to there's a couple of more options here in this dialog. We've got the opportunity to create a partial view. What this does is, in cases where we don't need all of the kind of surrounding cruft on our page, our template, if you come from the forms world, the ASP.NET forms world, it's kind of like our master page. If we don't need that stuff wrapped around it, then we can just create a partial view and then prevent that additional template items to be rendered. A case for that would be if you're using Ajax and you just want to request something that maybe fills a table or populates some divs. The next piece is whether or not we want to use a layout or master page, and in this case, we do. So it will, by default, it will assume the one that we specify in our view start file, and the instructions are here, and we'll have a look at those files in just a moment. When I click add, it takes what it knows about the person through reflection, kind of does some discovery over the properties that look like they should be displayed, and then it tries to do that for us. So I'm just going to head back to my person controller here and make sure we've got a number of pet sheep. I do have 4, I must confess. I live in rural Manitoba, and we're allowed to keep sheep on our property. So this is what I'm doing here just right now, just the simple class, James Chambers, number of pet sheep is 4. I'm going to hit F5. We're going to see the application pop up, and then we're going to say, hey, where do we go? How do I get at this person? Well, let's have a look again here about thinking about what our routes do for us. I know that if I want to go to the About page, I'm going to Home About. I also know that index is my default action. So if I am thinking correctly, I should be able to type person here because I have a person controller and I want to go to the index. Index is the default, person's the controller. We should be good to go. Bada bing, bada boom. There we go. Number of sheep 4 for James Chambers. Good stuff. I may have run out of demo god luck at this point, so I won't try to do anything without looking back at my project from this point forward. Okay. So again, this default view is scaffolded out for us. We've got just the property dump. Doesn't look too pretty. So how do we kind of make this dress up a little bit better? Well, this index.cshtml file was generated for us. It opens it for us in Visual Studio. But again, if you're just learning the project kind of layout, what you want to do is go into your Solution Explorer and have a look at this views directory. Our views are grouped by controller. So already we've got a person controller, a home controller, an account controller. We can see these directories inside here, and this is the convention. The views for the person controller will first attempt to be loaded out of the person folder in the views directory if you don't specify an alternate view location. So inside this person, I got my index page, and that's how we can find it. Now, another interesting way to do it is if you are in a larger project and I'm over here on index.cshtml, Visual Studio 2012 has this great little feature that lets you sync up your active document with the location of the Solution Explorer. So just by clicking this guy over here, pops me back into that view and I know exactly where I am in my project, in my solution. So again, back into this view here, I can see here, I'm gonna close down this field set. I'm just gonna collapse it so we can look at how little there actually is in the page. Now this is similar to any templating that you've probably used before. The person object that I created was set up as the strongly typed object that we're gonna be using for this view. So my view is strongly typed to a person object. Whenever I type model, at this point, so using the Razor syntax to invoke code here, I'm going to just type model dot. Now I get IntelliSense access to all of the properties on my model. So this makes this basically eliminates any of the, for example, if you used to do things out with string matching and things like that, we don't have to worry about that anymore. We get strongly typed members now inside of our views. This has been around since Razor was introduced. So that's some great stuff that we get there, IntelliSense off of our models directly on our strongly typed pages. But you don't see, like, while we see here that we've got index, and I'm going to just quickly pop into my route. Actually, I could modify my route and set up my person controller to be my default route for the application. But there's another way that I can do it as well, and that's through the properties. So I drill into properties for my solution manager here and Solution Explorer, and in the web, under the web category, I want to go to a specific page, and all I'm going to do is go to person. Now when I run the app, it's actually going to go to my person controller. You can see up in the browser, it's going to whack person and loading up the person object that we've instantiated. So there we are. But I wanted to show you that in there, from that view that we had, all we really saw was the index and then the properties being output, but there's all of this other page that's being generated from a template somewhere. So where's that coming from? Back inside our project, I'm going to go back to our views folder, and we're gonna have a look at a couple of other important aspects of the views folder. First of all, there is a web config in here. This is separate from the web config that's at the root of your project, and it does some things for you, like wiring up namespaces that you want to be able to use from your pages. This is important. Another one of those building blocks that you're gonna have access to is HTML helper extension methods. And when you start writing your own, and you will, as you use MVC more and more, you're going to need to wire up your pages to be aware of those namespaces inside this location in your web config. That's an important component to remember. Another piece that we've got here is this shared folder. Now, to show you why this one is important, and again, it's known to the MVC framework, but I'm going to go here to really quickly, I'm going to pop back into my person controller. So I'm going to need to stop my application here. I'm going to return a view called foo, which obviously doesn't exist in the project. Now when I go to the person controller, it's going to try and find this view, and it's going to fail. So this is actually one of my favorite error messages that I've seen from a lot of different applications. Not only does it tell you what it tried to do, but it told you, not only does it tell you that it couldn't do what you were trying to do, but it also tells you all of the things that it tried to accomplish for you in order to resolve the problem that you were facing. So looking at this, it said, the view foo, or its master, was not found, or no view engine supports the search locations. And then it says where the search locations were. So it started off in views/person. That's because we're on the person controller. It looked for an ASPX, an ASCX. Then it looked in views/shared. Again, that's that known folder that I was talking about with the MVC framework. And it looked for ASPX and ASCX. And then it tried the CSHTMLs and the VBHTMLs in both person and shared as well. And it gives you a stack trace with a bunch more data that isn't really relevant, because at this point, we have a really good idea what's going on. It looked for a page, it looked for a view in all of these locations and could not find it. So, why that is important is because if you want to share views across multiple controllers, you can simply put them in the shared folder and it will be located for you automatically. So I'm going to go back to returning my person here. And we'll have a look at how the rest of the cruft gets built around the page that we've got. Because again, this index really just has this index view that we've got really just has the title and then the dump of our property data. Well, in our view start that we talked about when we were scaffolding a view, It says that the layout to use, the default layout to use, is this guy right here, the layout.cshtml that's located in the shared folder. And that's this guy right here. This is the place where we wanted to, if we wanted to change, for example, let's see, right now it says my MVC, my ASP.NET MVC application. This is in the footer of the template. I can change this to webcams rock. And when I compile and run the application, all pages, because this is a template that's wrapping everything for us, all pages will now have the footer that says webcams rock. And it doesn't matter what page I go to, because they're all right now wired to use the same layout, by all means, they all have the same footer automatically generated for them. This is another important part for you, because you're not limited to having one layout. And again, as you explore the MVC framework, you're going to find that perhaps a user is in a different role. Perhaps you want to have a layout for people who are authenticated or not authenticated. And the view start gives you an opportunity to specify the layout that you want to use, depending on some of those conditions. You can also do it at a page level. So in the index, for example, up in this code section up at the top where we're setting the title, we could also set the layout here and just specify an alternate layout that we wanted to use. Okay, so moving along, just make sure we've got a couple of important things covered here. We have our views, again, are part of that MVC piece. Our views have their own directory. Our models have their own directory, and we've created that person class inside here. There's also the account model that's created for us automatically. And inside our controllers, we've got account, home, and person. Any of the controllers that you have that inherit from controller, that base controller class, will automatically be available through routing. So we've got those routing bits as well. These are kind of some of the fundamental building blocks that you're going to want to be make sure that you're familiar with. We also got this authconfig class. This is an important one because the MVC framework has adopted the OAuth web security library. And the OAuth libraries allow us to connect to third-party authentication providers. We can get claims-based identities out of these providers and actually allow people, for example, who are already users of Facebook, Twitter, or they have a Google account, or any other that you want to wire up or that there's a client available for, you can simply enable these, including, I guess we're doing a Microsoft webcam here. The Microsoft client is available as well, so you can log in with your Microsoft account, the same one that you use to log into Windows 8 or your Hotmail account, those kinds of things. You can use that to log into your web app as well. So the authentication authorization bits are fairly important, and they're fairly simple to make use of. So for example, if I wanted to say that if you want to use the index page if you want to view the index view on the person controller, you need to be authenticated. I'm going to say authorize first. And that way, when I try to access the person, the MVC framework is going to automatically take care of this for me and say, hang on a second, we're protected by this security attribute. We require the person to log in. So instead of allowing them to go directly to that page, it's going to ask me to log in first. So I'm going to type in James. I'm going to type in that password that I just created. And now after I've authenticated, hello James, I'm right back here. I'm going to log off, go back to person, and it's going to ask me to log back in. So it's by default, again, I'm using just the simple membership that's automatically created with the database that's automatically built for me, just simply by convention here in my application. But if I want to take this further, I can, and I can dive in and integrate Facebook, Twitter, anything that supports OAuth, simply by going into this auth config and setting up the key and the secret that I've registered with those applications for. So there's great tutorials out there. There also, as part of this series, I believe there's some information on this. So dive into that a little bit deeper if that's something that's interesting to you. Facebook has, I believe, 1 billion accounts on it. So if you want to have a user base of 1 billion, out of the gate, that's a good way to impress angel investors. So maybe start there and add Facebook authentication to your application. Now, moving through these, we've got bundle config, we've got filter config, route config, web API. We've already talked about route and we've talked about auth. Let's talk about bundling for a quick second as well. Bundling and minification are an important piece of building fast websites that load quickly, especially in mobile browsers. When we have a number of resources that are required by our page, be it script, CSS, or otherwise, every single one of those resources is a separate request that needs to be made, and there's payload around that. Now, further to that, if there's white space and comments and those kinds of things, then that bloats our request and response even further, particularly the response coming back to the user. And we want to make sure that we can get rid of that for all kinds of reasons. First of all, we want the page to load quickly in various scenarios. But secondly, we also want to make sure that we're controlling our bandwidth so that we can scale as well as possible. So to leverage bundling and minification, we just kind of need to know that background. And then the next step would be is, well, how do we reduce that request footprint that is required by our application, and how do we make our resource count go down as well? So the minification takes care of removing things out of our CSS and JavaScript as much as possible to remove all of the white space comments. It'll even take a function name, a long function name, and squish that down to a single letter or two, and just kind of doing everything it can to squeeze bytes out of it. Bundling says, hey, here's all these scripts that I have, or here's all this CSS that I have. Let's wrap it up into one file and just deliver that to the client. So now if I put all of my JavaScript libraries into one bundle, and I put all my CSS into one bundle, and now instead of having 17 or 39 different requests that the browser needs to make, it simply comes in on one or two requests, one for the JavaScript, one for the CSS, and they're as small as possible using minification. So by default, what happens for us is just through the project template, you can see here that jQuery UI, and a couple of things for us to support, validation, unobtrusive validation, and some AJAX request, AJAX-based validation. These things are already pre-wired for us. These bundles become available at the locations. You basically name where that bundle is going to live. And in this particular case, we're saying that this bundle that includes jQuery is located at WAC bundles WAC jQuery. So if I go to my site and type in, I'm just going to let this authentication fail first, and I'll go to bundles/jQuery. I'm running an IE, so it's actually asking if I want to run or save the file. But I can actually, at this point, I'm just going to leave that for now. What I could do is actually download the source that's being bundled and minified for me and have a look at it. There's a couple of smart things that go on inside here. One of them is the semantic version tag. This token gets replaced for us using semantic versioning rules. This is all part of an effort to reduce the touch points that are required when things like script versions change. So when jQuery releases a new version, and they've go from a 1.8.3 to a 1.9.0, we're going to want to take advantage of that in our application. If there's things that we need to take advantage of, we're going to want to upgrade our application to use it. Well, rather than having to go in and edit all of our source files, this is another reason, by the way, why this comes in so handy, bundling and minification, because the bundle takes care of all of the source code for us. We can now also, using this semantic version token, we can actually just replace the JavaScript library in our scripts folder, and the latest version will automatically be used by our application. So drilling into scripts to have a look at it. In this particular case, I'm sporting the ever so current jQuery 171, and that is what is being returned to my client through the bundling minification. So this goes. There's a lot of other files that are being included in here. Some great ones in here. The unobtrusive validation work that's been put together, as well as Modernizer that kind of puts HTML5-ish behaviors, CSS support, those kinds of things, kind of fakes it out through JavaScript for older browsers. Some great stuff there as well. And of course, all of all of the required files for a jQuery UI are in here, broken out by feature so that if you don't need to, for example, use accordion or slider, which happen to be some of the larger ones in the library, you can just eliminate those CSS components and just kind of pass them over, reducing the size even further. So there's really great ways to optimize your site and deliver as small bundles as possible to the end user. I'm going to jump back in really quickly to my layout.cshtml. One of the best practices that we can kind of take part in is moving our jQuery and our scripts that need to be loaded on the page to the bottom of the page. That gives other things like images that are more important, CSS that's more important to controlling the style and layout. It gives those a first crack at the resource, at the bandwidth that's available at the end user. So down here you can see that in order to render that bundle that we've got, where do I get my jQuery now that I've put into this bundle? Well, I simply put it in the scripts.render. Helper method that we've got in Razor here. And we've got bundles/jQuery. That's, of course, the same name that we used to name our jQuery bundle. And now without having to change anything in any of my pages, because it's in layout, I get jQuery everywhere. And because I've used semantic versioning, I get the latest version, whatever's installed in my application. Let's head back up and keep looking through this app start. There's still a couple more important things that we should look at. First of all, we've got a global error handler that's built in. I've actually put some more information on how filters are used and how you can use them. So be sure to check out my blog. We'll post the digits at the end here for you. Understanding that request pipeline and how things line up is actually pretty important because when as you look for further ways to extend and leverage what's there for you in the framework, you're going to want to know how filters get wired into controllers and what they mean and how they influence actions. This is an example one. You can actually get the source code for the handle error attribute online. So a great way to explore and see how it's interacting with the MVC pipeline. Now we've looked at route config, and then the final one would be the web API config. Web API is a great way to build out RESTful interfaces, if you will, to do a lighter weight API that's supported in your application. Now, we'll actually cover that in a separate talk. So for right now, I'll kind of pass over this. But what it does for you here is it allows creation and consumption of web APIs directly inside your application. So you can now access things via, for example, jQuery AJAX requests, getting JSON copies of objects out of your database and things like that. Again, another great thing to look at, whole list of things to explore there on your own. Definitely warrants a separate talk. Okay, now we've got our own person wired up here. I'm just going to pop back here and we'll make sure we're keeping track here. We've got our own model controller in view. The next thing to do is to kind of look at how we're going to persist this. And we're going to do that today through the entity framework. The entity framework and particular code first. Now I've already got this person created. I'm going to have a look at this guy over here again. I've got this class which represents some data, and in this case it's data that I want to store in a database. So how do I get this guy to kind of get persisted from session to session? Well, we're going to need a database. We're going to need a table. Thankfully, if we are working in an environment where we don't have access to DBAs and we don't have approved processes or we don't have processes that we need to work through controlled DBA or DA kind of roles, then we can, at this point, kind of do a lot of this DBA work hands off. And Entity Framework Code First gives us this great way that, by the way, is also friendly to our DBAs, but it gives us this way to do it hands off in our development environment. And to output migrations that can either be executed dynamically or we can extract the script from them and push them out to a DBA via source control and things like that. Now, to get started, pretty straightforward. I'm going to go back to my models directory and add a new class called sample context. Now, the context represents our database. So we're not going to create a context for every entity that we want to store. I've just slightly misnamed that guy. I'm just going to fix that really quickly so I don't confuse myself later on. But we, again, we only need the one context if we're, when we're dealing with multiple entities. We don't need a separate one each time. I'm going to inherit, from DB context. And I've just added my using statement there using the helper in Visual Studio. And the next thing that I want to do is create the representation of the table. So I've got the representation of the database. Now I want the table. So I'm going to add a DB set, and I'm going to make it a generic, use the generic version of it called person. And actually, I'm just going to make this as a property, just use the helper there. So DB set of person, and we're going to call that guy people. Now, thankfully, that's all I have to do. I now have a database and a table. So I'm going to do one last little trick here, and I'm going to create a constructor here, public sample context. And all I'm going to do here is call the base constructor and name this for me. So I'm going to call it sample context. This is important for a number of reasons. First, this is the name that will be used to build your database if it doesn't exist. So sample context becomes something that's very easy to locate for you when you're looking at LocalDB or SQL Server Express or SQL Server, whatever you've got wired up. It's the name of your database is going to be called sample context. Otherwise, it's going to be a long string of your namespace and whatnot. So this just keeps it simple for us and allows us to control the name of it. Now, it's more important than that even because what happens is when Entity Framework first does, before it goes off and creates a database called sample context, it actually will try and find a connection string called sample context. And that's going to be what it uses to locate the database. So when you think about deployment scenarios where we're pushing out to a deployment for IIS or out into Azure, we're going to want a way to control what that connection string actually looks like. We're going to need a way to swap it out. I see that I've still got my sample context spelled incorrectly, so I'm going to change it one more time and then finally allow Visual Studio to rename it for me, and now I've got my sample context. Now I'm not doing anything in this constructor, though I could. I can also add as many entities here as I want to. Right now I've just got the person object in here in the people table. But now we're ready to actually start saving some data. We want to put it into the database. I'm going to go back to my person controller. Now, this is another thing that I love about scaffolding. I talked about it as a kickstart before, but my person cruft that I've got in my application, I'm not connected to it. I am not married to my code in any way whatsoever. So I can just delete that stuff, make it go away, and because scaffolding is so easy to restart those things, I'm just going to drill back into my tooling here. I want to make a person controller. This time, though, I'm going to leverage the Entity Framework bits that we've already got set up. First, I need to build my application so the context is available to tooling. We talked about that before with person. So I'm going to add a controller called person controller. Deleted my old copy. And I'm going to use this guy right here. This scaffolder is the MVC controller with read-write actions and views using Entity Framework. As you can probably guess, it's going to create a controller for us. It's going to be strongly typed. We're going to specify that in a second. And it's going to build out our controller for us with all the appropriate actions for CRUD capabilities. And it's also going to build our views. And it's going to back that with Entity Framework. Now it's going to ask me, which model class do you want to use? Again, I'm going to use person. Pardon me. In here, I'm going to use my sample context, which is the name of the database context that we created. And that's pretty much all I have to do. I've specified and said, hey, I've got this context that I've already created that I want you to use, and here's the object that I want to create some things for, i.e. the controller and the views. And so it just builds that for us. Up here, it's got a private member variable called DB. That is an instance of our sample context. You can see it doesn't have anything fancy to call as far as a constructor. It just assumes all the default conventions that are being used for Entity Framework code first. And right now my database does not exist. So this is not a compile time or a code time operation. When my database gets created, it's actually at runtime when the Entity Framework can't find the database either via connection string or physical existing database where it's looking by default. So I've got this database that's going to be created for me out in the future at some point. We're gonna wait through that together. I've got my index method. I've got details. I've got create. I also have edit, delete. So the kinds of CRUD things that you would expect to have. Now, we can also here look at the views, which have the create, delete, the details, the edit, the index, the pages that you're going to want to see when you go to that controller. Now, remember, my default page that I'm going to is person. So, and I have removed, well, because we deleted that old controller, there's no longer a requirement for me to authenticate. I don't have the authorize bits on there anymore. This time when I go to person, the index method is trying to fetch a list of all the existing people that are in the database. And of course there are none because there is no database. So we're going to see this white screen for a while it spins its wheels and goes through all of the process of trying to create a new database in the appropriate tables. And it's done that for us. So at this point I can create a new person. You can see there, this is not a view that I've created. We've been building this project as we go. Creating a new one, and I can now go in and say the name is James, the last name is Chambers, and again, four sheep, bylaw limit for the number that we can have on our property, and of course it gets created. And if I try and go into the details of it, then of course we see that same default scaffolded view of details. I can navigate back to my list. I can delete it. It even says, whoa, timeout, are you sure? There's livestock we're dealing with here, and I can just abort this operation and say back to list. Now, of course, go in, I can create as many as I want to, so I can go in and create Joe Smith, and you can see we can just kind of keep building this out. Now, in a nutshell, Entity Framework Code First gives us a really quick way to kind of build out these database kind of concepts that we need to have as part of an exciting website that our users are going to want to visit and come back to. Almost every website that we use on a daily basis, be it blogs or video sites or search engines, they've got something that's backing them that you're going to want to represent in a similar way on your site that you want to push out to the user. This gives us a really low entry bar to get data not only stored in the back end, but then pushed back out to the user for them to see on the other side. The next piece then is we want users to be able to see it, and they're not going to see it if it's sitting here on my laptop. I want to push this out, and we're going to push it out to the cloud. I have a slide for that. We're going to show that one right now. Pushing slides out, or pushing your code out to the cloud. If we only take a minute to do this, you should not be surprised. This has gotten very, very straightforward. Now setting up your Azure account only takes a couple of minutes. You can just go to windowsazure.com. There's all kinds of resources there that you can learn more about. But the most important thing is going to sign up for the trial. We will post links for that at the end of the video as well, where you can go and sign up for your free trial for Windows Azure. I say that's important because you will get 90 days of the full kit and caboodle. There are some limitations because it's free, but you can explore all of what's there to offer in Azure. But more importantly, after the 90 days, you get to continue using websites for free, up to 10 of them in shared spaces. So there's no reason not to do this, and it becomes a great way for you to go out and set up and start working with Azure on a regular basis. I've created this one called WebCamper. You can see there's nothing out here yet. It tells me that the website to go to is webcamper.azurewebsites.net. So again, this is a website that's been created inside Azure. All I need to do is hit new, and then it's going to kind of wire up some things for me. You can do a quick create, you can do a custom create, or you can select a website that exists out from the gallery. So getting things like WordPress set up as a blog for you is crazy easy to do. And there's a whole host of other things, CMS, e-commerce, forums, blogs, all that kind of stuff is out there. So have a look at the gallery, explore that. Quick create just cuts a website for you. You can get started right away and start publishing. Custom create gives you a couple of other options. For example, if you want to set up continuous deployment scenarios using source control, things like hosted TFS or GitHub repositories. Those are the kinds of things you can do when you do the custom create. You can wire up databases directly through the creation process. You can do all of that stuff afterwards as well. But this step gives you, this kind of gives you the cat's meow as far as how easy it is to get things set up and wired right from the start. Now that I've got my site created, I just kind of drill into it. I get all kinds of great options for keeping track of what my site's doing, how many users I'm getting, how many errors I'm getting. I can look at logs. I can look at the resources that are linked into my website. So this is a great dashboard and just probably something better than you've got if you do something like I did, where I used to rent a VM from another provider out in the cloud, and I was running my own instance of IIS. Now, the thing there is I don't get any of these dashboard kinds of things, and I've got zero ability to scale because that VM is now, I'm paying for that guy, and I've got all kinds of things on. Porting it over becomes a big deal, whereas inside Azure, scaling this guy up is simply a matter of, as the users start pouring in on my ever so popular person website, I can simply just start moving up in tiers here and just dropping up to 10 instances in here right away and supporting literally tens, hundreds of thousands of users. I'm picking the size of machine that I need in order for this thing to kind of kick out both of those people that I've got stored in my database. If there's lots of users, you could generate loads, so you may need to scale up. I'm gonna just cancel out of that. It's gonna prompt me to save my changes. I'm just gonna say no. Going back in here, the next important thing, we're talking about deployment. The next important thing is attaching our project in Visual Studio to this copy of our website out in Azure. The easiest way to do this, if you're familiar with WebDeploy, it's been around for quite some time, it is a phenomenal way to push your websites out. And with the tooling enhancements in Visual Studio, you can now make WebDeploy very easily part of your CI process. So to start that, though, the first thing we need to do is get the publishing profile. This has been around since WebDeploy 2.0. So download the publish profile. We're going to get this little file that we're going to save in our project directory. I'm going to save this guy as, throw it into my downloads, create a new folder called camp. We'll go in there and copy this path just so I can get at it easier. I'm going to save the publishing settings to disk. So now I spent a couple of minutes talking about Azure, but I want to just highlight that all I'm doing to publish is I click that download publish profile and save it to my computer somewhere. Inside Visual Studio, I say build, publish, and the first thing it says is, wait a minute, you don't have any publishing profiles. We need to import one. So I'm going to start there and hit import. Of course, I go to the directory where I saved it. And then without any effort at all, I've got this connection set up, and it knows my password. It knows everything it needs to do in order to connect and deploy my site. I can click the validate here just to prove that this is working. Of course, it could just be a spinning box, but I promise it is working. We're going to validate this connection, and then as part of the deployment process, we get to set up some other configuration options as well. So as soon as this is done and I get my green checkbox, I can move on to the next, and it's asking me which configuration to use. This is the configuration that you've got inside your build environment, and you can set up as many as you want. So if you publish to multiple client sites, if you publish to multiple endpoints in the cloud, if you have test servers that are used for acceptance testing when you're running automated tests, this is how you get that wired up. And I'm picking my release here, and there's a default connection that's being used. That's for membership. The sample context is the one that's being used for my, the sample context is the database that we were, that we had named inside of our DB context. So that sample context now is, we're saying, hey, map it to my actual database that I've got set up for me in Azure. And it takes care of importing the connection strings that are available. If you have multiple databases set up, you can select those from the drop-down box there, And then you say, use this connection string at runtime and update the destination web config. This is brilliant because I don't need to do anything to have my website now switch from running locally to running remotely in the cloud. I am going to do one last thing before I start here. I'm going to close this down. I just don't want something to run away on me. We're going to be looking at entity first. We're looking at the code first pieces. I want to look at migrations. And just so that I don't run into some complications with my database, I'm going to first enable migrations in my project. Just a quick step, you do it from the Package Manager console. And it's telling me that I need to specify the actual context that's being used. So I'm just going to paste that guy back in there. I'm doing it for sample context. I enable my migrations. And away we go. Our first migrations are being created, and we're off to the races. So going back into my publish dialog here, I'm going to publish my selection. It's going back to here. Now we've got under our settings, we're saying now we've got the option to execute code first migrations on application start. So now as my database gets updated and I have new migrations that come in, which we're going to visit in a couple of minutes, as those new migrations come in and we make changes to our model, then this we can actually say, hey, go execute it in the cloud for me as well so that users will see the latest versions of our objects. Finally, we can do a preview. And what this does is it helps us establish which files will be updated if we do a publish at this point in time. The first time I'm going to push it, it's going to say, you know what, you have a whole bunch of stuff to push. There's a couple hundred elements to a stock MVC website, and they're all going to show up here because they all need to be pushed out. So again, I'm making it sound longer than it takes. From Windows Azure, I download my publish profile. Inside Visual Studio, I import the profile, and then I hit the publish button. And as you can see, because I just nexted through those wizards, it didn't take much to get going. I'm going to just type in person here to go to my person controller. And now you'll remember locally, I had created the database already, and I had two people that I'd created in there, James Chambers and John Smith. Well, those won't exist out in the cloud because I didn't push any databases out there. All I did was push my EF code first data, and that enables the in the cloud for the website to be created again. So the entity, the code first pieces, the migration pieces, those are being executed for me now up in the cloud. That's all it would take to kind of get wired up. I'm hoping we're going to be able to cut that out and kind of debug that later on. That's kind of the important bits in a nutshell. If we I'll just go back to my application here. The deployment just literally takes minutes to push out to the cloud and seconds really to push out to the cloud. Subsequent deployments, if I make changes, for example, I'm going to go into my edit page on the person and I'm just going to I'm just going to add some white space. But when I save it, the next time I try to publish, everything is already pre-configured for me. It's saved inside here, and when I hit start the preview, we're going to see a lot fewer files actually get updated. So a couple of things to point out. Edit, CSHTML, that one is being modified because that's the one that I just added white space to. The web config files, though, will be touched because they're being transformed by our release configuration. We've got the config transforms running through chained config files in our project. The same with any configuration files that we've got throughout the .NET framework. And then I can publish again, and that edit page will now be updated. So very simple, very straightforward to wire up. So I'm just going to cancel out of this dialog, not save it. Those are kind of the principles that you need to get deployed, the principles that you need to kind of wire up a database and start saving some models, saving some entities out to a database. We walked through the kind of the overall general picture of what's available inside of ASP.NET MVC, and hopefully you'll recall right from the very start, all I said was it's as simple as doing a file new project and picking the MVC4 template out of your web category in the project templates. There's a lot of great resources that we I've mentioned a couple times. We are going to post those in the tail end of this video here. Again, my name is James Chambers, and just glad to walk you through some of these features that are available here, and hope that you're able to follow along and maybe have a little bit more success.